Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for November 29th, Saturday, 2008. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I'm with the IR News Service Economics. And our topic today is the isotope economy, pathway out of the dark age. I'm very glad that we have to discuss this. Larry Hecht, who's with me here in the studio, the editor of 21st Century Science and Technology. Welcome, Larry.
Hi.
And we have from coast to coast, that is from the Atlantic to the Pacific, we have the LaRouche Youth Movement activists, Ivan Korpis in Boston. Welcome, Ivan. I think we have some connection problem, but oh, there he is. Ivan.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, great. And out in Los Angeles in California, welcome Rachel, Rachel Brown.
Hi, thanks, Marcia.
Thank you all. And I just want to begin today's discussion after introducing you by going to Lynn's introduction to this topic of the isotope economy, because 2 years ago, when this an article by that name was published in the Executive Intelligence Review and in 21st Century Science, Mr. LaRouche wrote a short introduction, and he referenced people to think of JFK's manned moon landing. And here's what he said, and think of today's crisis. He said, in light of the fact that the world's present monetary, financial, and related institutions are already trapped within an accelerating process of disintegration, it is urgent that the relevant alternatives be placed squarely now in the center of discussion. This isotope economy proposal is intended for prospective adoption as a policy orientation. It is identified for this purpose as key to organizing a durable long-term replacement and recovery from the inevitable early disintegration of the present global system. Well, 2 years later, we are in the midst of this quickening disintegration all around us. The economy's breaking down and the financial system's completely dead. So I'll just tell you right now that LaRouche, who's been keeping very busy, is in the process of writing a new strategic paper. The title is The Truth of Bretton Woods Lies Within Physical Science. So again, he's turning to what is real physical science, not this globaloney stuff. And the that will be posted on our own LaRouche our EIR news service site, LaRouchePub.com, and also certainly faster on LaRouche Political Action Committee's website. And in the meantime, before we lunge into the discussion here on the isotope economy, what are we talking about? Breakthroughs, science. Besides stupidity that we have to deal with, and all of humanity having experienced being dumbed down, there's some really filthy networks in action. And I just reference for you that this terrorism in Mumbai that you've seen for the last 48 hours, that Mr. LaRouche and others in India and elsewhere in the world have conferred, and there's no question this is part of the kind of dirty business that the what you could call the neo-British East India Company, British intelligence, is up to. And there's breaking news on that. There's a certain individual that's been identified named Dawood Ibrahim. And there is a press release on this on www.larouchepack.com. I recommend people look at that because there are efforts to create chaos, destroy nations, terrorize people, instead of the regrouping that we are committed to and that we're now going to discuss today. So with that, why don't, Larry, you can begin anywhere you like. We could say, what is an isotope economy? That wouldn't hurt.
Well, let's do it this way. We've got a proposal out now from the new administration to create 2.5 million jobs. We keep hearing that number going. And you look, that's nothing wrong with that. But then you look at what they're talking about. They say that they're going to have people building windmills and green energy, windmills and solar power mostly. So people want to understand why. Well, a job, that's a job, isn't it? So is building a pyramid or digging a hole in the ground for no purpose. But it's typical. people need to understand why, what the problem is there. And unfortunately, it's typical of the this generation of economic advisors, of economists, and even some scientists, that they wouldn't understand that, what the problem is there. And so this, we'll address this over the course of the show. Let's keep that in mind. And this goes to the heart of what is this isotope economy proposal. Now, of course, most of the listeners probably know we've advocated nuclear power. And it is a fact that nuclear power is between 1 million and 10 million times more energy dense than any existing method that we have for producing electricity and heat. But that in itself is not, even that tremendous power advantage is not really the point of what we're talking about with the isotope economy. What is really the point is that over 100 years ago, just about a century ago, and a little more, we had a discovery of a fundamental breakthrough in science, the sort of fundamental discovery in physical science, which began with the Marie and Pierre Curie's separation of radium. And what that breakthrough represented is the possibilities inherent in that breakthrough, both in terms of our deeper understanding of nature and in terms of what we can do with it. That is where the real question of the isotope economy lies. That is where the improvement in man's power over nature, which is what is necessary for the human race and for the world, that's where it lies. Any other approach than the approach we mean broadly by the isotope economy, which of course includes nuclear power, it includes electricity generation by nuclear energy, but that's only one piece of it. In one sense, a big piece, in another sense, only a small piece in terms of technological applications of what we're talking about here. Any other approach will not be able to sustain the present human population of 5 to 6 billion people with any existing approach other than that. So not only is this proposal, the proposals being put forth by the new administration, or mostly to the new administration, not only are they incompetent from an energy standpoint, but they're incompetent and deadly for the survival of humanity. So that's the general point I want to out here.
Can I ask one thing? Because you said it isn't just nuclear power itself for electricity, yeah, which is dramatic, yeah, which is an important point, and there are many other things that can be discussed. I hope we do, medicine, many mm-hmm. things, agriculture. But one thing is these so-called green recovery proposals you've been talking about. That's one mm-hmm. of the names for them. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't even be a recovery, but one point about all this is that there's the assertion, well, resources are so limited, we're running out of coal, we're running out mm-hmm. of it, that the implication being there's a fixed stock of natural resources mm-hmm. and somehow or other mankind's reached the mm-hmm. point where it's all over everyone. Mm-hmm. That's the end. So if you would say more on that, that's the other aspect.
Right. Well, that's a good way of looking at exactly what, maybe a good way of defining exactly what was this breakthrough that we've had in our at our fingertips for almost a century. Maybe people understand that, they can understand more clearly, rather than just throwing around some numbers of this is a million times more than that. What was the discovery? At the time, we're talking now the late 1890s into the very, just the turn of the century, 1900 to 1903 period. There had been a great revolution preceding that discovery of atomic energy, of atomic power or transmutation of elements. The great revolution before that had been the revolution in chemistry. And all of chemistry and all the breakthroughs dating back to approximately the time of Lavoisier, who was the great French chemist, flourished before the French Revolution, and as many of you know, was beheaded with Robespierre saying the revolution, the famous revolution, doesn't need scientists. Lavoisier had made this revolution in chemistry, which was based on the idea that when you have any kind of transformation that occurs in nature, if you take the principle that whatever goes in comes out. So if you have a reaction of inorganic reaction of an acid and a base reacting, or water and any kind of chemical reaction, or even a reaction such as photosynthesis or respiration, which is one of the interesting things they studied. Whatever chemical element, the chemical element is the smallest reducible part of that reaction. So the elements coming in are the same as the elements coming out. And taking that principle and refining the methods of dealing with, especially weighing, a very big part of it was the refinement of the balance. We made a revolution in chemistry, a revolution in man's control over nature, which led to the Mendeleev's discovery of the periodic table about 1868-69. It led to the revolution in organic chemistry, in tremendous improvements in medicine and so forth. So when Curie's made this breakthrough in about 1900 and isolated this new element called radium. This was a tremendous work of years of very intensive labor, literally physical labor, processing tons and tons of the what was called the ore called pitch blend to reduce out just something less than an ounce of radium in their first try. You had this new element with this new property, this radioactive property. Following that, you had the work of other physical chemists famous among them were Rutherford and Soddy, a New Zealander actually, he didn't get to go to Cambridge and all of the fine schools, and was sort of an up and coming type. Unfortunately, later as he was absorbed and knighted and absorbed into a controlling role in the British Empire, he played a somewhat negative role later on in science. But at that time, in his young days, Rutherford and Soddy made a revolutionary breakthrough about the period 1902-1903. They saw that this principle of chemistry, that whatever comes in is what comes out, sometimes called the conservation of matter, didn't hold in the case of this new substance, radium, that the Curies had isolated. They saw that something else was going on, that there was an actual change in the elements, which what we call transmutation. The element coming in was different from the element coming out. So from that, in the decay of radium, and the same occurs in the decay of other radioactive substances, what the radioactivity actually is, as we understand it, an atomic nucleus giving off a certain amount of energy and also transforming itself into another element. And there is a whole, they were the first to work out the decay series which radium was a part of. And then it turned out there were many more, and there was much more work to be done, so that by the 1930s or so, we had a pretty good understanding of the periodic table with respect to this transmutation of elements. But just a beginning of understanding. What it meant was that we could now, that the question that Marcia just raised apparent shortages of raw materials and so forth is no longer really the question, because we can actually change elements. So we can actually synthesize new elements and change elements and also produce things that have these other qualities, these qualities of emanation of enormous amounts of energy in the form of fluxes of neutrons or electrons or gamma rays, which is very high energy radiations, all of which have tremendous potential, most of which is yet untapped, because we've only begun to understand the meaning of all of these things and what they could do. So that is the kind of power that we have in our hands when we speak of nuclear power, not simply the ability to produce electricity, as important as that is, but the ability to transform matter and to control new kinds of very high energy radiation that give us untold possibilities. So when we speak of the necessity, so let's say we take the same number of people and put them to work building windmills, and an equivalent number of people and put them to work building a nuclear power plant. In the simplest sense, we could say, well, the nuclear power plant will be much more energy dense and will be much more effective. And we won't go through here all the problems with windmills of them being, everybody knows the wind is erratic and all those sorts of things. They need backup and so on and so forth. But it's something much bigger than that. And it's much bigger than what we would, than the electricity that we would get out of the nuclear power plant. Because what we're talking about is that we have to transform the labor force itself from a labor force that is relatively, unfortunately, especially in recent years, becoming less and less skilled in many ways in terms of capabilities, in terms of mastery over fundamental scientific principles. That doesn't hold everywhere. We have some specialized people who are gaining skill, but overall we're losing skill. So we would need a transformation of the labor force in around this concept of isotope economy to where people would be increasing their mastery over such processes as nuclear transformation and isotopic changes and so forth. This would be the direction. This would be the direction you should think of in the labor force. Not just do we create some jobs, but what are they and what's the quality? What's the quality of mind of the workers involved in this?
Right, Rachel and Ivan, you may want to jump in at any time. I think there are many questions posed here. I have some, if you don't have one right now. But Larry, if you could just do, say in an indicative way, the kinds of things you mentioned, the nuclear plant, but say in medicine, or I've seen botany, botanical agronomy experiments decades ago.
Yeah.
About how you could affect plant life and plant growth, or how you can affect body healing when it comes to the human body through some kind of intervention of specialized energy forms, let me put it that way. And this would be the kind of thing that on the frontiers of science would be getting somewhere. I mean, decades, we've just stalled out, I guess you could say, for about 40 years.
Unfortunately, was as we were talking about before, when you come across the U.S. actually shut down its capability. I mean, since there are many known uses in cancer treatment, for example, for various isotopes, you get a radioactive isotope with a particular characteristic. For example, when in a nuclear reactor, one of the things that happens is that the uranium nucleus breaks apart, it fragments, and produces a broad spectrum of lighter elements lighter than uranium. Almost nearly the whole periodic table, except for the very light and the very heavy, is there. And many of these elements are not in their natural form, but in the form of an isotope that is unstable and therefore is radioactive. Of course, this is the very thing that the Greens have tried to play up with the big fears and so forth. But this is fear-mongering. Many of those radioactive isotopes have important uses, and one way to get them is one way to produce them. Another way to produce them is you can specifically tailor and produce that isotope with a neutron flux, a flux of neutrons, which is a byproduct also of a nuclear plant, and often the way it's produced with test reactors. You irradiate a particular unknown substance with a flux of neutrons, and it actually changes. It transmutes into something else that's a useful radioactive isotope with just the right half-life and just the right output of energy that medical research has shown is tailored to a specific use. And on this score, it turns out so that there is a great deal of advance in medicine in this area. It turns out in many of the treatments of cancer and some other disease conditions, Europe is way ahead of us on this, largely because of the level of hysteria. Not that there's in some ways it's worse in Europe, but in fact the level of hysteria about nuclear power has produced a situation where most of our medical isotopes now are being imported. We're getting them from Canada,
maybe South Africa,
from South Africa, from the Petten reactor in the Netherlands, which is the European state-of-the-art reactor for producing these medical isotopes. Well, you know, some of these isotopes have a short half-life, so there's an advantage to being close to get the full use of them. Sometimes you're talking about a thing that decays in just a matter of a day or two, decays down to half of its useful effectiveness. That's what the half-life means. But even that, you know, what we know now, what I like to think about is what we don't know. We know an enormous amount about medical capabilities. You know, in the very beginning, when you talk about plants, I recently I was looking into the history of photosynthesis. One of the big breakthroughs in our understanding of photosynthesis, and one of the very first use of what's called radioactive tracer isotopes, was in the study of photosynthesis, in the study of what happens to the oxygen. Originally, we thought it was simply that the plant takes in carbon dioxide, converts that carbon dioxide into carbon in the structure of the plant, and essentially exhales oxygen. It turned out it was vastly more complicated than that. There were all these intervening reactions and very complex cyclical chain reactions and so forth, and also that even the oxygen that came in from the air exchanged with the oxygen, there also has to be water present, of course, exchanged with the oxygen and the H2O of the water, and then went into the plant. So all of these things were learned through the very early application of radioactive tracers, and it's still being done. Probably the one of the really big questions, and something that I've looked into, though I wish I had the answer, but let's say the question anyway, that can sometimes be the beginning of it, is what is the difference between the living and the non-living? Of course, in one sense, it's obvious. It's easy to tell something's alive or not. But the same chemical composition, if you take a person or any animal or plant and examine it at the moment before death and at the moment after death, you're not going to see a fundamental change in the chemical composition. Yet something obviously very different has happened there. There's something is going on in the life process that is fundamentally different, so that even though it appears to be an assemblage of raw
carbon
materials,
and this and that.
Chemicals of this and that chemical and chemical processes and so on, there's something else there. Now, one of the ideas that LaRouche suggested to me for looking at that question, which relates to the work I had done with Dr. Robert Moon on his hypothesis on the nucleus, is that you have isotopes. You have isotopes that seem to be uniquely associated with life. What is the possibility of a change in the isotopic? Maybe we should back up and talk about what isotopes are at a later point, but let me just say this. What is the possibility of a change in the isotopic composition in the normal isotopic distribution between living and non-living things? It turns out a little bit of work has been done on that. As far as I know, asked the question in the way that LaRouche posed it, but some people investigating this sort of thing have come up with some interesting things. For example, it turns out from the survey of literature that I was able to do that in the human blood, you have iron, of course, is a crucial component of the blood, of the hemoglobin molecule. Turns out that the relative amounts of distribution of the iron isotopes, which is, you know, iron has I think four major isotopes in the it's been a while since I looked at this. You have iron 56, iron 58, and what, 54, and another one I can't think what it is. That the relative distribution of those isotopes shifts very considerably in the blood. There's a concentration of one of them, and it's not, I'm not remembering right now which it was, and a depletion of the other, and actually the whole array shifts. And you know, you say to yourself, well, what is it? The blood is obviously a key part of any living process. What is it in there that's causing that isotopic shift? So this is the sort of thing that we're talking about when we're talking about the isotope economy. We're talking about discovery of new processes. We're talking about the questions we don't really know the answer to yet.
Well, let me shift, if Rachel, unless Ivan wants to interrupt here, to the kind of thing on the economy side, which is all tied up with it. What Larry said has indicated we if we would go ahead with this, we're definitely going out of the current dark age, and it's a fabulous upshift for civilization that we'd be engaged in. And Rachel, you looked in the past at the time of the development of the steam engine, the conceptualization of power, and literally the physical work to make a working steam engine. And this, of course, wasn't just one single wonderful thing that could power, as I'm afraid Thomas Jefferson said, it would be good for churning butter. He had a slightly limited view of all this. But Rachel, you were looking at the big upshift in civilization that occurred from that period. Could you say something about that, your historic studies or otherwise your personal experience in looking at the physical side of life?
I don't know about that example exactly. It's been a while since I looked into that. This one example of the same type I could reference from what LaRouche has brought up recently is in methods of transportation. Well, I mean, several things. One, in terms of your energy sources, what it takes to transport different energy sources is an interesting dynamic question of economics. But then also what your method of transportation is another completely integral method. And this is sort of another way of looking at the idea of an isotope economy as transforming the way people relate to each other in an economy. Just for example, I guess Larry brought up some of it, and he can go through it in a much higher higher idea, but just some of the basics for maybe people that haven't thought about it a whole lot before. The idea of the energy density of coal versus the energy density of uranium. Now, well, the uranium energy density is 3 million times that of coal. Well, what does that mean for the cost of transporting this good in your economy? Because obviously you would need a lot more energy to transport the coal. That would be a whole lot more coal. So then you have the question of, okay, well, now you're transporting this stuff. Well, what are you going to use to transport it? You have rail, you have roads, or you have airlines. Now, we used to have rail, and that was a pretty efficient source. But then you also have roads and air, which have sort of taken over our method of transportation. Well, are those the most efficient modes of transportation? You know, you can transport a given amount of goods on a bunch of trucks as you could on a train, but what are going to be the costs of maintaining the roads that those trucks use, or the fuel that those trucks use, or the number of people you need to drive the trucks, or the cost of your lack of energy efficiency based on people being stuck in traffic because of those darn trucks. So I just kind of like to think about the isotope economy from that standpoint of how this would change the fundamental ways people relate to each other in an economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the amount of effort and people and physical effort involved in something so heavy and bulky as coal, it really is.
Yeah, the last time I looked, it was something over 80% of the ton mileage of the railroads today is involved in simply hauling coal.
Right.
We've virtually converted our rail network, which at one time was was the infrastructure of the industrial economy, into a coal hauling facility with deteriorated rail beds and so forth. It's really
terrible. November, the harvest has come in the United States and the Midwest, corn and everything else, and it's displaced by all the coal hauling. So more and more of the grain is going on the trucks. Mm. So the whole, yeah. You're right. Could either one of you get a hit in here, again, back to this green recovery insanity, where they talk about, you know, little mini biofuel cars or hybrids, or then there'll be lip service to the hydrogen car. But would you say the same, bring out the point there?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's something I always like looking into. I used to like to fix cars. And well, these new Japanese ones, you don't require as much repair. It's nice, but it's the older you get, it's harder to crawl around under there. But anyway, I do have an interest in this question of what you might replace the present automobile with, And of course, hauling oil, whatever the price of oil, hauling oil, and whether there are pirates off the coast of Somalia or not, this insanity, this modern day dark age that we're in. And even so, hauling oil, you know, thousands of miles around the Cape and up to the United States or over to Europe, so forth, is rather, again, to, like Rachel's example of hauling the coal. Why do that when we can produce hydrogen or hydrocarbon fuels locally? One of the advantages of the new generation of nuclear reactor, the high temperature reactor, is that you can get up to temperatures of around over 750 to 850 degrees centigrade, and at those temperatures, it becomes very efficient to split water, and split water into its components, hydrogen and oxygen. And of course, if the oxygen goes back into the atmosphere, that's a good thing. And the hydrogen we can take, and we can use it in two ways. We can take it directly and compress it, and use it as a fuel with cars. Of course, there's some technological problems there to be dealt with in terms of compressing it enough that the car will have sufficient range. And also, we can combine it with coal. We can do this near a coal site and combine it with coal, not the huge volumes that you would need for energy generation, but much lesser amounts, and get a liquid fuel as a substitute. And you'd probably, the Japanese who've looked at this very closely have thought of a kind of a combined method of liquid fuels and gaseous hydrogen fuel for different purposes. The liquid fuel having the advantage of being like gasoline, being extremely energy dense, and you'd fit it in a small container, a gas tank. So we have the ability to then locally produce fuel. It's not surprising that the Japanese, having an advanced industrial economy and virtually no local source of oil, have looked into this the most seriously and are making strides on it. So a hydrogen substitute fuels for hydrocarbons is certainly on the agenda, as is the other side of it, which I kind of like. Maybe I'm more favorable to this, is the electric car, where again, of course, you know, that depends on battery technology, and we've made great advances there with lithium ion batteries and so forth. There are still some things to be worked out. But the possibility of the latest, now we have these hybrids, which aren't so bad, but we could possibly, the hybrid has to have a gasoline engine as well as a battery pack in it, but we could move towards plug-in electric vehicles at some point, maybe plug-in hybrids as a transitional measure, and then a plug-in all-electric vehicle. But of course, if we're going to do that on any large scale, we're going to have, if, in other words, the electricity would replace the gasoline distribution system, then we're going to have vastly more electrical power. One of the advantages of this is that you can use most of the plugging in would be going on, you'd drive a car home at night and just plug it in the garage, and most of that would be going on at night, so it would help equalize out this problem of peak power, needing a large amount of power in the day and not as much at night. But nonetheless, we're going to need lots more power. So again, we're talking about the capability of the new generation of nuclear plants to produce high heat and power. This is a wonderful thing. We've got a we'll be posting an article soon on the 21st Century website, which my wife wrote, called "The Nuclear Power Revolution." It appeared in the last EIR. I think it was the November 21st EIR. And we'll have it available to everybody soon on the 21st Century Science and Technology website. You can just Google that and get to our magazine. And by the way, we also, I guess this is my commercial part, we also have up there right now, I haven't addressed this question, but I'm sure it's on your mind, or if it's not on your mind, if you're trying to organize other people around these ideas, it'll be on theirs. We have an article called "Yes, We Can Reprocess Nuclear Fuel," that addressing the question of fuel reprocessing, addressing the question that the Greens always raise of, oh well, you know, you get all this nuclear waste, and what do you do with it? In fact, we have an article up there by the man, Clinton Baston, who was the very down-to-earth engineer. I think he was a Georgia Tech graduate way back in the late 40s or 50s, who was responsible for his entire career as a government official in Washington for supervising nuclear fuel reprocessing. And he goes through the in every aspect the has very interesting things to say about what's the best method. It turns out, in his view, this DuPont Canyon method of a nuclear fuel reprocessing proved to be by far the very best. Of course, we shut these systems down in the United States. Anyway, the whole story is there, but on fuel reprocessing. But to get back to the new generation of nuclear reactors, which my wife's article addressed, the nuclear power revolution, we can generate this high heat. And we can the two systems, one system which is made in America is the General Atomics high temperature modular helium reactor. The other system, which was developed in Germany and now was first developed in Germany, called the Pebble Bed, and now is in the hands of, it was developed by the South Africans, by the energy company Eskom. They're similar with some variations in the configuration of the fuel rods, but essentially both of them have in common that the nuclear fuel is pelletized, and then the pellets are put into somewhat larger containers. But it's pelletized, and each little fuel pellet, you know, the size of a BB or something, or even smaller, is self-contained. That is, it has multiple layers of carbon and pyrolytic carbon substances on the around the small piece of uranium that's contained in there. So one of the big advantages is that you don't need a containment building. You don't need the expense and size and so forth of a containment building. So therefore, you can make these reactors. That gives you the advantage that you can make these reactors smaller. They have a negative energy coefficient, so that as they heat up, the reaction stops. So that you don't even have to, even in the worst case scenario, and these things have been run with, you know, they've run them to a danger situation. They shut down because the heat itself shuts down the reaction. They also have the ability to generate heat to generate a steady source of heat around the 800 degree level, which is considerably more than our current generation of light water reactors. So that we have a revolution right there. We can produce hydrogen out of these things. We can produce high temperature heat for industrial processing, for refining ores and so forth. That can be done right there, and we can produce them in a smaller size so that we can modularize them for serial production, somewhat like the way that we produce aircraft, where it's not mass production as you do in Detroit, or used to do in Detroit. Sorry, with the with automobile production. I guess we still have a little bit there left, but it's serial production like aircraft. So where that greatly improves the efficiency over our current generation of nuclear reactors, which are produced on site, and each one is a little bit different. We could modularize and produce, say, 200, 250 megawatt modular reactors, or 200 megawatt modular reactors, which can be put in series for, you put four or five of them together for a major urban area in a developed country like the United States or parts of Europe. But it also means you could take those 200 megawatt reactors and plop them down in a country in Africa, which doesn't have yet that highly developed energy grid. But they could use 200 megawatts of power. It would it would transform the society in the same way that what the United States went through in the 1920s and 30s with the development of electricity and the TVA and so forth, just transformed people's lives. There are people today older people today who still have the original switch box, fuse box, where I recently saw a wonderful documentary on TVA of the power coming into their homes. People living in one of the poorest parts of the United States who were transformed simply by the application of electrical power. It's something we take for granted now, most of us. This can transform the lives of people in parts of Africa where AIDS is the predominant. The four horsemen of the apocalypse are walking or riding, and AIDS is wiping out the youth population. These are countries already in the process of destruction. We can change that, and we can do it pretty fast.
Well, just Ivan, you've been looking at scientists who, instead of being involved in any aspect of what Larry's just describing, whether it's kind of, sorry for the expression, pure science or applications or any of it, in the last 40 years as the Dark Ages got worse and worse, you've been looking at some wild things that physicists turn to. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I was reading a biography, an autobiography of a mathematical quant, that is one of these, computer programmer / applied mathematicians / financial engineers, which was a new job that was created on Wall Street in the 90s, at about the time of the creation of the derivatives bubble. And it turns out that the most interesting thing I found was that this branch of the derivatives market is using applied math and pseudo-physical laws of physics to model financial derivatives and to model financial markets. You could say that it was a CCF operation. That is, it was launched by the same Congress for Cultural Freedom that was deployed to destroy classical cultural ideas in the United States and the morality of society at large in the United States, and to erase the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt and what he'd done to create optimism in the society. And moreover, there was an ideological seed planted in this time period in these physicists in the 60s, which grew into a really amoral and kind of mercenary use of applied mathematics on Wall Street to create this, this grotesque quadrillion-dollar financial derivatives bubble, which is effectually the enemy of mankind right now. This is the cause of our problems.
Yeah, it didn't work very well, did it?
Well, no.
It makes you wonder about the science when what they can produce is the worst economic
disaster. Yeah, in its own terms, it's failed.
Well, that's what they say, because a quote from this, the guy's name is Emmanuel Derman, who is the 2000 Financial Engineer of the Year. And he says, well, in physics, the beauty and elegance of theory's laws provides a natural starting point from which to proceed. In finance, there are few beautiful theories and no compelling ones, so we have no choice but to take the phenomenological approach.
Yeah, meaning there's no truth.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. What these guys are looking to do is make money for their owners. And a lot of these guys went through the university circuit, spent 10 years as graduate students, and actually developed a hatred for humanity in the process. And so they were no teaching jobs because of the anti-science turn in the West, in the United States especially, and they turned to all kinds of applied sciences. Some went into computer programming, some went into telecom, and others went into finance. And what's happened is that it's lent the financial markets an air of scientific validity, which it doesn't deserve. And if that's any reason why people are holding back from canceling this derivatives bubble, hold back no longer.
Well, let me ask you one thing, because you're in one of the campus centers of the world. I'm not saying that's good. You don't want to get any terminal diseases off there. And Rachel's out also Southern California. But what could you say about the inclination or disinclination of the public now, especially youth or students, to have had reality whack the whole country on its head, and be open to the kind of real questions of science and economic conceptualization of economy we've just been talking about? What do you say, Ivan?
Well, I would say that the potential always exists, but it really is a question of what kind of lengths we're willing to go to make it happen. I was reading a report by LaRouche from 2006 on the Mumbai train bombings in the summer of 2006 in order to get insight into what happened last night. And he says that what's required is a painful kick in the rear end from reality and economic hardship to lift people upwards and to compel them to evolve society, for society to self-evolve. And while I think that that's true, I do think that it's that much more important for the leaders of society, the self-appointed leaders, to take on the kind of challenge of inspiring the population to cause the society to self-evolve. And one way that we're doing that out here in Boston is a lot of concentration on classical musical performance, and we're hosting a regular series of music salons where we're inviting the population in to enjoy classical beauty in a musical setting. And it's working. I mean, it really does communicate the kind of principles that, you know, people don't want explained formally. Nobody wants to go through a formal analysis of a Bach fugue or a Verdi opera. People want to enjoy this stuff and be moved by it. And we hope that this is one of the ways that we'll be able to resuscitate our generation, which is kind of unfortunately on its heels right now in terms of getting organized for an economic recovery.
And that is science. And of course, the really crucial thing that LaRouche added to my understanding and to the world's understanding is this breakdown of the separation of the, or you know what the Germans call Geisteswissenschaft and Naturwissenschaft, between art and science. That science is a, so that what you're doing when you're reviving classical culture, classical musical culture, is you're reviving classical scientific culture. Because science is this uniquely human endeavor. The discovery, when we're talking today about nuclear power, possible practical applications of nuclear power, we're going back to a history of several thousand years. We're going back to a recent several hundred years of Avogadro's discovery, for example, and Mendeleev's, and then what the Curies did, and then the understanding of nuclear transmutation and all the ways that that was worked out. That these were the crucial breakthroughs. There were very individual. There was something in a single human mind, an absolutely unique transformation that occurred in a single human mind and changed the entirety of society. So a single thought or complex of thoughts, something with actually no material weight, and you couldn't, and its energy is almost non-existent or very small energy in terms of caloric content as you might measure it, and yet it has the power to change the Earth and even the nearby solar system and someday the galaxy. So that we have to, I think it's important to remember that. I'm glad you brought up the music, because it's important to remember that that's what we're really talking about when we're talking about science.
And I wanted to ask Rachel too, you're there in California, which is special in a lot of ways in human history with its, I'm sorry that it's the home of Schwarzenegger right now, the Governator. But in your experience with, likewise with the public or with youth in particular, do you think realities hit people a lot, and in the midst of the fear and the reaction, they're more open? Or what would you say about engaging people in conceptualizing now?
Yeah, they're definitely more open. And I'd say it's in both ways. One tendency with people, both youth and the older generation, although the youth don't have it as much, is the tendency right now to try to batten down the hatches and weather the storm. And so that's something that we totally have to get out of and instead go with, well, Lynn makes a point in his latest paper that we have to define the relations among nations from the highest standpoint of mankind. And as Larry was bringing up before, this is the principle of the isotope economy. How people relate to each other is going to be in a much higher level of thinking. So that when while we're in this crisis now, that the idea of an isotope economy is actually a really great way to give people optimism about how we can transform the society. Because people in our generation haven't seen it in our lifetime. We've never seen a fundamental change in the way people interact with each other. So reminding them that if we do batten down the hatches, we will not only not succeed, but we'll go backwards in history, is just really necessary right now. That instead we have to give them this principle of optimism of what the potential changes can be if we think from the highest standpoint of what mankind can do.
Rachel, I'm looking here at your article. I just wanted to remind you of one thing you wrote. It's for everyone, it's in 21st Century Science and Technology. It was back in 2004 in the summer. And you said at concluding an article you were writing, and you were discussing human creativity. You had been looking at the article's called The Paradox of Motion. And you said, one must not ask what effect does humanity have on the universe, but what is the nature of the universe that it created humanity? Very beautiful, because we're getting in all these green recovery programs, mankind is destroying the universe, we're breathing too much, we're emitting all these gases, and the animals we eat are emitting gases, and it's hopeless, and the youth, it's all over for you, because everyone before you used up all the resources. And so humanity had a terrible effect on the universe, which of course is, that's the insanity. But again, to repeat, you said, what is the nature of the universe that it created humanity? So is that what you're talking about here? What you just said, providing the optimism?
Yeah, definitely. Thinking of the universe as organized by human creativity, and that because of that, human beings do have the power to transform society. That is our role. We shouldn't, that while we're in a crisis like this, we shouldn't think about the budget constraints or honoring the bad debt, as a lot of people think of as a moral virtue right now. We have to honor every single financial contract that's out there. And actually, one of my friends put it really well. He said, we need to ask now, sort of in the method of Martin Luther King, not what will happen if we don't honor the debt, but what will happen to humanity if we do honor the debt. And
right.
But yeah, I mean, definitely taking it back from what you brought up about, well, yes, this must be the principle of every action that human beings make is the idea of man as a creative individual, and that it is creativity itself that organizes the universe.
Yes. It reminded me of Lynn's, this very inspiring talk that Lynn gave, I think it was just a week ago Saturday, where his point was creativity is bigger than you, that creativity is a principle of the universe, that however small individuals and the way society is organized today, it's to make everybody small and everybody slavish. But no matter what the power of the evil that does that, creativity is bigger than that because it is a principle, it is the organizing principle of the universe and therefore can't be stopped. But that what you're facing, that the struggle you're facing within yourself, or all of us within ourselves, against this really oppressive skepticism and pessimism, but it's all crap, that's all in violation of what the universe really is, and therefore it's a beautifully optimistic idea that therefore it will be overpowered.
One example of the pessimistic, it's worse than small-minded. Isaac Newton, I understand, Rachel, from the article you wrote in 2004, was at a meeting where a Leibniz associate, Mr. Pepin, was proposing how to have a steam engine. And you said that Newton said, oh, it costs too much. And let me just tell you, I read a lot of letters of Handel, the famous George Frederick Handel, the German who was trying to civilize England. He wrote the creation. He wrote the Messiah. Well, he overlaps Isaac Newton, and in one of the letters that Handel, in his correspondence, he played, and Isaac Newton heard him. And Isaac Newton said, "Oh, Handel, he just plays too many notes."
Cost extra. Why not save a few?
You're right. Oh, that was just, someone asked Newton, "What'd you think of Handel?" Yeah. Said, "Oh, he was all right, but really, he just played too many notes." So, I guess you have to laugh because the Dark Age is pretty dark, but there's hope we can get out of this. Ivan or Rachel, you may want to throw something else in here, but while we have the final few minutes, I wanted to ask Larry, is there any anything new or you want to say about the attacks on the Gore hoax? I'm putting it wrongly. You know what I mean?
Oh.
Any new uprising against that particular Al Gore tosspot hoax? You know what I mean?
Oh, I don't know. As we're go, I always think as we're go, they tend to get a little quieter as we go into these cold winters. I've noticed they like to hold their big conferences on hot days, and I have the sense that it's a little bit harder to talk about those things as people are concerned about, you know, having food on their table, but as I raised it in the beginning with the question of this so-called green jobs, this is
yeah,
such a hoax. Now the new, maybe the new form of the hoax.
Yes, and to underscore that, it is the case. For example, right now there's an international conference for 3 days in Dubai. Mm-hmm. By a certain form of this, it's called the Millennium Development Goals Group. It was formed especially in 2000 and 2002. George Soros was involved in it in 2002 in Mexico, where it said the way to help poor people in the world, and this is appealing especially to so-called church networks and others, is give them a little more handouts, and otherwise we'll just all have to hold hands because of the climate change and just, eat less, do less. Jeffrey Sachs is there. It started yesterday. It'll end on Monday. There's a certain kind of publicity, but it's a form of the Al Gore genocide. And there's also stimulus packages. We've mentioned this kind of insane green recovery, green jobs business. But Italy just announced one. The European Union's announced $250 billion worth of a stimulus package. And as you know, President-elect Obama this week said, we're going to build roads, schools, and have green jobs in these new vehicles. So we've really... and let me ask Ivan, do people react in any particular way to, as they did to feeling the bailout was a piece of crap, which it is, or have you picked up, what do you find is the, when you organize among people?
Well, I mean, a green job sounds good to somebody with no job, but, it's really just a case of not understanding the principles of physical science and the history of humanity enough to understand that we can't afford to take these moves backwards. I mean, it's the simplest thing to see that without like a sudden shift in nuclear power, it's not even a question of supporting humanity, because most young people who they still don't do their homework because they're addicted to video games or things like this. You know, they don't want to take on the responsibility for, supporting or providing power for all of humanity. But we can't compete as a national power against countries like Russia, Kazakhstan, China, other countries. You know, hopefully Europe is going to go back to nuclear power. South Africa is going to provide power plants for Africa. I mean, we can't compete against these countries as a first world power. And I mean, it's a little bit of a more immediate sense for people that, your delusion of, you have to think not about like how inspired you are about a president, a figure like Obama and the nice things he says. You have to think about what kind of economy you're going to be living in. What you have to paint a picture for people. What is daily life going to be like for you in 20 years if we don't make these changes, if we continue to support a bailout?
Well, I'm sorry that we seem to have run out of time, but I'm so glad we were able to talk today. It's November 29th, 2008, and I thank Ivan, Rachel, Larry for this discussion. I ask you to listen also to December 6th, when Harley Schlanger will be here with other guests, and especially look on LaRouchePac.com, www.LaRouchePac.com, for this breaking expose that you need to know on these British intelligence networks connected to this Mumbai massacre. And I thank you very much. This is Marcia Mary Baker, and we'll talk to you again next week. Thank you. The LaRouche Show.